Hello, welcome back for the second half of William Hartnell's first series. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm Richard. Good morning.
And you are listening to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast where if you've had yours, you could have lent her hers.
Excellent. Billy Fluffs. Just keep coming, don't
See, they weren't fluffs, they were carefully planned.
Carefully planted.
Yes. Carefully planted on the Chesterfield of reasonable comfort.
And speaking of carefully planned, we're going straight in with that carefully planned masterpiece epic of the story, The Keys of Marinus.
Now, it was my responsibility to do a lot of research, and I learned a fair amount about architecture and German expressionism in preparation for this
Silence
episode.
Silence from this corner of the podcast.
In preparation for this episode of the podcast. So, this was my one. This was allocated to me on the grounds that last episode I said that I was the only person I knew who loved this story to death.
And it is the story that does divide, if not conquer.
Well, yeah. Precisely. And so I did a great deal of research into architecture and German expressionist filmmaking. And I found that really none of it helped at all in any way with an understanding of how this
Mr.
story
Bottomley
works.
Mr. Bottomley gets a bit front-bottomy at this point. But, you know, I take it all on board.
You're getting the explicit tag.
It is, however, a Ray Cusick design.
Is it?
And I kind of
love Mr. Cusick, so...
Especially the city of, is it Morpheton?
Morpheton, the city of Morpheton. I've dated some of those. I've actually worked for a lot of them, if not. Yes.
So the idea here is, this is very different from anything that we've really seen the series do. I mean, the series do before. This is our second science fiction story. So we've had the Daleks. We've got a second science
Thank
fiction
you.
Story.
At
the
is moment, it a science fiction story,
yeah,
though?
Well, let's just say.
I don't feel it is.
There's a computer. There's a big computer.
It's got a big thing that goes warp, warp. But yeah. It doesn't feel science fiction to me.
No, it's got aliens.
So it's using, let's say it's using the tropes of science fiction to tell it. Sort of
See, that's
story.
Where we disagree. I don't feel it's this story ever gets beyond drawing room 50s
no,
drama.
No. It's good. Let me prove
okay.
it. Okay, so we don't know what we're going to do yet. We've done the Daleks. It knocked it out of the park by accident. Do you know what I mean? What are we going to do? We've got Terry Nation back. We've got Ray Cusick back.
It should be note perfect.
And I think it's better than people... give it credit for. And I think part of the reason is that the show hasn't sort of bedded down yet into stories. Cheers.
Cheers.
It hasn't bedded down into stories. You know, the idea that, you know, now from The Savages onwards, there are no individual episode titles. It's just part one, part two, part three. And as fans, we all think of stories that way. And so we think that that it's The Keys of Marinus and it's a six-part story. But of course it isn't really that. What it is it's a series of one-part stories, then a two-part story, and then we go back for a sequel to the initial one-part story. And so it's a little bit more like the first series of rebooted Doctor Who, where there is kind of a link between all of the episodes, but each episode is in a different place and has an individual episode title. And so I actually think that however tiresome an individual bit of it might be, it's over quite quickly. Do you know what I mean? And you're telling stories in 25...
Too many windows, too many revelations.
But, you know, you're telling stories in 25 minutes, and so they never get bogged down. Do you know what I mean? And they tend to be quite simple and resolved in quite a simple way. And I think that's quite fun, you know. And everyone gets a week off, and so you get sort of slightly different regular cast each episode. And, I mean, it is sort of standard, tiresome Terry Nation stuff, like in the stuff on Millennius, you know, where Ian's charged with murder, I think twice people inadvertently blurt out their plans.
Yes.
And then I was watching something the other day where it was in a Dalek master plan where someone inadvertently blurts out the fact that, like Mavic Chen inadvertently blurts something out, you know, and ruins his whole plan or something. you know, so it's all those sort of tiresome Terry Nation things, but they're still not really tiresome yet. You know, when we've sat through a few years of Blake 7 and Destiny of the Daleks and stuff, we'll all be truly exhausted by them. But
you're right, they're still new. Yeah,
they're still reasonably fresh.
And we have some amazing cast members. We've got George Kalouris, as straight from Orson Welles Theatre, you know, worked with the wonderful Patrick McGoohan and Mr. Welles himself as, you know,
Fiona Walker.
I was going to say, and the redoubtable Fiona. Irredoubtable Fiona.
Francis DeWolf?
No, I have no idea who that is.
Francis DeWolf, the trapper.
Vasor, the rapey Vasor. It's so bizarre as well. And this is kids' TV. Really, really early on, it's like a lot of the times people are rapey towards Barbara. And never towards Susan particularly.
They're really creepily, so yeah.
There's a stack of it, though. Like, she's going to be forcibly married or something. And Vasor is really chasing around that heart.
Yeah, there is no ambiguity in that scene at all.
No, there's not.
And when you go back to, say, An Unearthly Child, at one point, Zar sort of reaches out to her. But it's more like, you know, She's so clean and well presented. You don't get the impression there that it's desire or anything. It's curiosity.
The first woman he's met with dental hygiene.
Indeed.
but he doesn't smell like a dead cow.
You know, Vasor is so repugnant that he treats Barbara worse than she is treated by a caveman.
Doesn't that say at all? If we're going on to the whole feminist politics of this first season, women are really there as symbols of, you know, to not be raped. The perils of Pauline thing, put the woman in a point of crisis so that she'll appear to be vulnerable and therefore sexually attractive. It's pretty nasty.
But they do.
But then again, that's exactly what our culture was.
But in a way, I think a lot of this could come down to Verity Lambert being such a strong woman in a male-dominated industry.
Yeah.
Whenever Barbara is in a situation of peril like that, she doesn't just wait to be rescued. No. Like, when Vasor's chasing her around, she throws a bowl full of steaming soup in his face. You know, she doesn't. She is put in those stereotypical situations. But she tries to fight her way out.
She triumphs every time. Yeah.
Inevitably, yes, she is rescued by Ian or another man.
Altos.
So, Altos.
With his little undies.
Yes.
In the snow.
With his thighs.
It did worry me, the thighs in the snow. Do you know what I mean? He must have been awfully, awfully cold.
Ian does have to rub his thighs.
It doesn't.
Oh, yes, Ian does rub his thighs.
Which is a thoroughly unpleasant scene, of course.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that was sarcasm. just getting back to Barbara, it's kind of weird because you have this tension of, yes, she is treated in a very sexist manner, but she responds in a very...
with strength.
She responds in a very strong manner that, unfortunately, is only noticeable because of the way women are treated in adventure programs.
But I guess I have to say that the thing is successful because it presents some really striking and memorable images. And the story sort of, I mean, you know, sort of mostly nonsense, really. But you know, the brains with eye stalks, I think that's fantastic. Barbara smashes the brains with eye stalks.
And the bell jars, 40, 50 years before Futurama. Wonderful. We had it first.
Yeah.
So, and there's also someone, is it Gatiss or someone who says that their first memory of Doctor Who is the ice soldiers waking up.
I think it is Gatiss.
That's kind of lovely. Yeah, yeah.
And again, just these sort of memorable images, and they know how to sort of make memorable images. So the story might be a bit pants or a bit simplistic, although I was never bored because I knew that this bit would be over with and we'd be on
to something
else. It's
a play for today done as we would have seen it episodically, weekly, just as it was done in many other means and many other ways on BBC and ITV. And I guess that's its blessing, and for me it's kind of curse that it's so wonderful that it's showing that Doctor Who can do anything and be anything you want through the medium of TV. Yeah. It's showing us what TV is. But it's also just kind of doing what other stations are doing in other time slots in the beat, but already.
It isn't massively inventive, but I think that's the problem this season with the science fiction stories. Like, we essentially get three science fiction stories, and we're alternating between historical and science fiction. And the three science fiction stories, none of them really totally work. And I think eventually, you know, they'll find, you know, menacing monsters and stuff are an important part of a threatening of a science fiction story that works, as it were, in the Daleks. There's no real threatening monsters in Keys of Marinus, and again, Sensor Eyes don't have it either. And so they struggle to find out exactly what they're for. And, like, I actually like the Sensorites, as we'll discover when we get to it. I like Keys of Marinus. I kind of like the Daleks, but they're not what the show's eventually going to settle on as its
maybe
way
not. But you see, I love Sensorites, and I think, and I feel my part of that is that I feel really strongly that the Sensorites can look dull to us now because it's such a trope. But that back then, it was the first show, in my belief, to give us the template for a real Doctor Who SF story, and it does it in a way the Daleks didn't do it.
Yeah, Alien does not equal evil.
It equals a whole lot of other interesting things.
And talking about the aliens in Keys of Marinus, the Vord, the big problem with the Vord The alien Vord.
Yeah.
And Yartek, their leader.
Yart, indeed.
Is that, you know, they turn up at the Pyramid of Arbitan to take control of the Conscience. And then the Doctor and friends are sent off to find the keys. And it's kind of like, you would expect then the Vord to go after them. So you've got someone chasing them. Which, of course, Terry Nation would return to later.
In the 1965 chase. Classic.
But it's kind of odd that it doesn't happen.
They
sit there in the pyramid waiting for the others to come back, which...
Maybe the Black Guardian was employed.
No, you've got it there. It's the passivity of the narrative. This is not how we know our characters to behave.
I can't decide.
I think that the Vord don't pursue them because they belong to episodes 1 and 6, which are separate stories. And so they're not into...
The Vord don't pursue them because they're some Freudian archetype of some kinky, slippery, rubbery thing with handles on the heads that way before the Cybermen is. I think they're actually one of the most sexually charged. They are the sexually charged archetype of this season. They are extraordinary.
Yartek looks great in a hoodie.
Oh, if you want to know how Yartek looks out of his hoodie, he turns up in... Sensorites with a lovely Billy Gray job, and then under a lovely hairdressing.
Who is he in Sensorites?
He's John in Sensorites.
He's the mad astronaut.
Yartek is John in Sensorites, kids. We're going to get to that soon. Don't forget, this is exact. I find the Vord really interesting. This is at the time, just before the Profumo scandals, we later discovered that Prince Philip, this can get cut. There were guys standing around in wetsuits doing unspeakable things, possibly whilst Doctor Who was being played. Do you want me to redo that?
No.
Well, just...
Under no circumstances.
Well, no, I'll just cut it down to you referring to...
So...
But all of this is true. And I do think that they do represent some really kind of...
They were designed to make Toya Wilcox all wibbly inside.
She does find the Cybermen sexy, doesn't she?
They're wrong on lots of levels. They're disturbing, and they're really sexually charged.
And it's interesting when you consider that they want to destroy the ordered society.
Don't they, though?
Of Marinus.
Mm.
Who doesn't? I love them, really.
Yeah. Well, when you
look at it,
and the thing is, you kind of then meet the people from all around Marinus, and they're a bunch of wet fish. Although the story does give us Doctor Who's first female villain.
Fiona Walker.
The eternal Fiona Walker.
Carla.
Yes, Carla. All things shall soon be hers. Yes. And indeed were.
And she is easily the best guest artiste in the story.
I think it's season one. I go out there on a limb?
I love her.
Oh, we've got the Aztecs coming up next year.
Yeah, but that's... It's Barbara being marvellous. Still Fiona Walker. Certainly female guest. She's it.
And the thing is, you know, she is given, as much as I love Keys of Marinus, she is given not the best material to work with. It's quite cliché.
Which just shows how great she is with it.
At the same time, it's cliché of a man's part, and it's being given to a woman. And much like Kathy Gale, and we keep referring to Kathy Gale, if you don't know who she is, Google her.
Even more so, she's playing Dietrich in Witness for the Prosecution, which we mentioned last week.
Yes.
The courtroom dramas are based very much, even the cutting scenes, on Billy Wilder, the great Billy Wilder, who gave us comedies such as Some Like It Hot.
Yeah.
And a whole host of others. Please Google him. Those courtroom scenes, if you don't know Witness for the Prosecution, Marlena Dietrich in A Silk Fascinator, interestingly, it's been pointed out by other critics, Billy's performances have been likened to hers. The way that he presents, the way that he reads his lines, certainly the way he works as, there was a whole school of acting at that time that you work with your eyes in cinema. Keep it really simple. Keep your face passive. Let your eyes do all of the work. Billy definitely does this, certainly in season one. He follows a lot of Dietrich's tricks, and it's worth looking at those. If you love Marin, let's look at the scenes of Hope of Trail, because Fiona Walker is definitely lifting Dietrich's performance.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised to hear that Terry Nation was lifting, you know, the entire plot.
Totally Ronioing it.
I believe that Billy and Marlena Dietrich actually wore the same wig for those scenes.
Well, there's a lot. It's not me saying it. I read it elsewhere. There's a lot of yeah. Billy's performances based on Dietrich's.
Yeah.
Does Dietrich do the hands thing?
Totally.
Really?
Dietrich built a secret train line from Berlin to get the Jews and the poofs and the actors out. She was the one who put most of the money up for reviving this underground train line that was dead and buried and getting out. I'll look up the facts and I'll put it on the
send it
on
to
the
me.
Page. It's wow. It's an extraordinary story. She did some amazing things in Weimar Germany, post Weimar Germany after Glasnost. She was a real hero to theatre all around the world and to actors, and her performances and her codifying, her way of performing was something that was looked at. I'm not just throwing her in as a reference.
No.
But Fiona Walker's performance is very much Dietrich's in Witness for the Prosecution.
Apart
from the fact that Fiona Walker is God's gift to this story.
And again, you know, another sort of rightly reviled story, Silver Nemesis. She's, fabulous.
I love Silver Nemesis.
But we've got about 2 years before we do.
If any of you are still with us or indeed still alive when we get there, yeah.
Not if you have to go to the doctor. Okay, sorry, political reference.
So are we moving on? Oh, no.
Yes, what did ding-a-ling? What did Rod say?
Nothing.
It's a new segment.
nothing funny until the censorites. So.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I think that was harsh criticism. This is Adventures with the Bloke in Space, isn't it?
Well, the whole... Oh, well, okay.
Shame on you, Rod.
His comments for Keys of Marinus were interesting ideas such as the acid sea and subs to get through it. Vord looked very alien. Excellent story. 7 out of 10.
I really like the bit where they're outside the pyramid and people keep falling into the pyramid. And it's like a magic door opens and then they're in the pyramid and everyone else is wandering around outside the pyramid going, ooh, where's that other person gone? And then they go in the pyramid.
It's carry on Marinus, really.
It's really terrific.
And following on from Ian's wonderful education of line of, do you know we still use the word hashish in English today, Susan, is... Look at this wall. There's no mortar. It must have been built with tremendous accuracy. And William Russell, by this point, is clearly just going, this is terrible, terrible dialogue. I'm going to have fun. Look at this wall.
Do you think it was a throw into the hashish thing? It's important to point out. This is the point where the Beatles are starting to smoke cannabis semi-publicly. Okay, they've done all of the Hamburg stuff, but this is the point where they were being...
64?
Yeah, yeah, no, when this story went out, this is the point where they were actually being shot smoking reefers.
Mm.
Kind of exciting, kids.
I will say, though, in that scene...
We don't encourage the use.
No, don't try that at home.
I will say, though, in that scene where Ian's getting terribly excited about the pyramid construction, he is camper than the time you played Ian.
Really? That's very hard to believe.
For those of you who don't know, Nathan once played Ian Chesty Bond, I believe the name was, in a Doctor Who play called There's Something About Magnus, the Guy Who Drained Me. More on that story later.
Oh, really? Do we have to have...
No, we really don't.
Well,
no.
Thankfully, we've just had the sound, meaning we need to move on to the Aztecs.
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, ding.
Okay, so the Aztecs is mine as well. And
yay! What a coincidence.
Yeah. No, well, this is one of the ones where...
What's not to love?
Oh, my God.
No. It's like Seeds of Death, right? In that I put the video on, and then by halfway through episode two, I was always sort of doing the ironing or vacuuming. and, like, I feel really terrible about it, because the fan consensus is that it's sort of terribly brilliant. And so I'm doing it properly as I watch my way through the series now. And so I did sit down, and I just watched it, and I watched a couple, you know, watched it in two settings, paid proper attention to it. And it has a lot going for it. You know, it's beautifully designed. It foregrounds Barbara, which is always a great idea. It gives Barbara and Billy lots of time to interact and things. There's all sorts of delightful things about it. But I still have to say that I don't quite get why it receives the fan adulation that it does receive. And I'd be fascinated to hear you two charming gentlemen.
Yes, it's very controversial.
Do you think? I'm trying to be cool. I'm trying to not be a dick about it. But
No, you're being fine.
But it is
just wrong.
And you know, part of it is that stupid, childish, you know, lowbrow thing that I have, which is, where are the monsters? You know, like, you know, if we had the Aztecs, seriously? And maybe some pteroleptals.
Really?
No, not really. But I know, it's embarrassing, but the historicals thing I actually find a bit boring because of the lack of science fiction elements. I'm so sorry.
And you're an educator of
it. I know. Like, the Romans is a notable exception, and I have to say that I recently enjoyed the Mythmakers as well, but...
Great. See, I find that the entire opposite. That it's an historical for me is a lot more interesting because we get to the real subtleties. To me, it's much closer to life. Once you put a bloke in a rubber suit, I'm not really in the room. That's when I actually turn the iron on. So the historicals to me, it's just, how am I fitting into this? How do I feel? What I love about this story is that it's Barbara giving us, it's Barbara's full entry into the narrative. She owns this story.
Yeah.
I will always love this story because it gives Jackie Hill a chance to be front and foremost. And my God, if they'd called it Jackie Who, I'd be, you know.
Bugger calling it Ian.
Yeah,
call it Jackie Ian. Who.
This is for me, I can't, I'd like to know what everyone else thinks, but this is one of the first feminist pieces of TV I ever saw. And it's this season that does it for me more than, well, actually, absolutely more than any of the others that come. It's about the women. For me, starting off, it's about Susan. As the narrative develops, because Caroline Ford is so shortly served and comes straight back from being an extraordinary extraterrestrial, us being the viewer, being in the narrative, to some irritating schoolchild who never varies beyond three emotions for the entire season until we get to Sensorites.
And they're panic, hysteria, and a slightly different kind of panic.
Got it. In one. Whereas Barbara can put on something that looks exactly like one of Peter Scully's fabulous designs for Mardi Gras and look totally at home. I will rule the world, and I'll do it fairly. Mm. And this is why I love this show. It's how do we, in the 20th century, look at our past? It is our past. We are an imperial culture. I'd like to throw in what you think about the post-colonial aspects of this season.
Well, you see, I don't think it is post-colonial, and I think that that's part of the problem that takes me out of it.
Well, yeah, Barbara is trying to colonize, isn't she?
But
is
she? No.
I thought she's narrating the... please, go on.
Well, because I think that the problem is that the narrative explicitly says that the reason that the Aztec society is doomed at the hands of Cortez is because it's immoral, because they have human sacrifice. And so when Cortez comes along, he'll be a moral
with his
force.
Kind, gentle, slaughtering ways.
Yeah, yeah, do you know what I mean? He'll be a moral force. And so there is a kind
pretty
of...
pretty close for us Australian viewers, yeah.
Well, there is a kind of post-colonial thing in that, you know, it's set in the New World. All of the characters are, you know, non-European and so on.
Yeah.
But the explanation for the fall of Aztec society is so horrible. Do you know what I mean?
And it's so dark.
No. I'm saying it's just historically wrong and Eurocentric. Like, Cortez doesn't triumph because he brings superior European values that outclass the Aztecs. Aztec society doesn't fall because it has human sacrifice. Aztec society falls because ruthless people with steel weapons and horses.
Because Cortez brings guns, germs, and steel, as Jared Diamond wrote. It's a great book if you haven't read it.
So
this, I don't believe this narrative gives us anything other than complete damnation of European culture.
Barbara explicitly says that the reason that she wants to put a stop to the human sacrifices is so that there's some hope that this...
The Cortez will be curtailed.
Yeah.
So Barbara there, she is a colonizing force, but she's trying to bring the best of colonialism.
Okay.
But she's trying to bring the idea of civilization, and not civilization such as, we will come and use your land and you will serve us. She's trying to bring, look, in our civilization, we don't kill people. Which... Of course, in England at the time, they still did for murders.
Yeah, yeah.
But Derek Bentley.
Only just.
But
you're right, because it was a major point of discussion in British politics and media at the time.
And of course, you know what? Barbara probably would not support that in the slightest. You know? But that's the thing. She's trying to bring this whole thing of...
Did we mention we love Barbara?
Oh, we do. Really? Do we?
Yeah, we do. I'm kidding.
But she's trying to bring this whole thing of, you know, I'm not going to bring the subjugation of colonialism. I'm going to bring the fact that you do not need to kill people to make rain. I'm going to bring education.
That's why it's exciting.
And it's Barbara, the history teacher, saying, I'm going to bring science to these people.
Yeah, and Ian, you can just shut up for 4 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
he kind of does, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
And he does some fighting.
And there's a lot of short skirtiness and thigh action, and it's kind of good. But
why is he better than the sort of Aztec warriors at front, just because he's our leader?
Better fed and taller. No, come
on. And the implication that...
And he's watched a lot of TV, he was in Ivanhoe, so he knows what to do.
The implication that Paul Cornell, Keith Topping and Martin Day bring in the discontinuity guide is that Ian did national service.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's right.
He's had hand-to-hand training. He's done
and
self-defense.
He's a gentleman.
And that means, you know, that he can hit someone with his thumb on their shoulder blade, hit a nerve, and they'll fall down, which
although
of course
Star Trek is
know.
Still 3 years away.
Star Trek, yes. But that brings me to what I particularly love about the story. Of course, you've got all the Barbara brilliantness of it. Brilliantness?
Yeah.
Brilliance.
Neologism's right here.
That's a word.
Brilliant! But what you've also got is all of the supporting characters... Are characters? Even Clotoxel.
What, you mean they're not real?
Can I just say Clotoxel?
Clotoxel.
Can you say that again? I just got a little warm.
Can you actually say it?
It's Quetzalcoatl for us kids who just read it out of the book.
But even Clotoxel, he's
that.
Not just...
It's a bilateral fricative. No, it really is. I'm paid to know
this. I'm going
to
be using that. Everyday parlance. Go on.
So Clotoxel is not just a villain who doesn't like the hero, so he's going to be the villain. He genuinely believes that this will be the end of his civilization if we follow these teachings.
And social imperative for opposing Barbara.
You know, Barbara says at one point,
Yataxel? How do we pronounce
it? Yataxa.
Yataxa. Who are we talking about?
Barbara's priest.
Barbara Yataxa.
Yeah.
Yataxa.
Barbara does say at one point, you know, he just wants power. But I don't think he does. I think he genuinely believes that if they follow Yataxa's teachings, they will all die. So he's
trying
to protect
the
people, as well as she's trying to protect the people. And then you've got Ortlok, you know, who's this beautiful soul, who's ready to listen to Barbara, but no one's ready to listen to him.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've got all these characters who are well-drawn characters in their own right.
And the villain is not actually a villain.
Yeah.
It's within the social constraints of his...
Yeah, it's like everyone is trying to do the best they can, not just for themselves, but for their culture.
Except for Ian.
He's fighting.
He's fighting away. Man. He gets to actually be the bit of skirt in this. That's another reason why I love it.
Oh,
the
actually,
bloke is right down there just performing a role.
No one has mentioned Keturah.
Kameka.
Well, it's the same thing, isn't it? Isn't it the same thing?
She becomes Keturah later, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yes, Kameka, oh my god.
Well, how Billy has his little bit of romantic frisson.
It's really sweet.
It is beautiful.
Look, I don't mind admitting I cry at the end.
Yeah,
no,
it's lovely.
Yeah.
And Carmen Silvera is delicious in
this.
She's just
lovely.
It's
not Carmen
Silvera.
Sorry,
it's Margot Vanderberg.
Margot Vanderberg.
For me, it's always hello, hello. That I got that totally.
No, you're just
I'm projecting.
Ahead of us.
I'm projecting. Yeah. You're right, and she's lovely.
She is terrific, and there is that thing. Do you like? you remember the rumours that when the Five Doctors came out, was being made, John Nathan Turner was going to prevent Carol Ann Ford calling the Doctor
grandfather.
Yes,
because the Doctor couldn't have sex because he had to be just like a Doctor Who fan, otherwise
because he's
lose.
A Barbie doll when you take his frock
yeah, yeah.
off.
We would lose audience identification. But, and so they always sort of retconned, or, you know, there was this sort of lack of, it was not comfortable.
I think the Eric Saywood wrote a short story where she was actually Lady Larn from the Dark Times.
God, I hate and, Five Doctors.
But, and we weren't really flirting or anything like that. But you look at it in context and it's really terribly sweet and Billy's quite smitten.
It's two elderly people who have both clearly lost people they've cared about.
Yes,
suddenly going,
yes.
Here is someone intelligent and worthy of me. And coming back to something you were saying, Richard, about the strength of women in this season, when Kameka realises the Doctor is leaving and he won't be coming back, she doesn't cry, she doesn't throw herself at his feet, or, you know, all of the female tropes that you would get in films around that time. She just turns away and then turns back and just says, just think of me, and walks off and goes back to her garden and... Oh,
it's probably worth noting at this point that we've just had this week the passing of Maya Angelou.
Yes.
The wonderful, glorious American writer and human rights activist whose words actually mirror this moment in that you own whatever pain, whatever grief, and you rise from it and you take pride in whatever comes to you because it just makes you stronger.
You rise like a phoenix.
You do. She's really worth reading if you haven't read her. I love everything she says. Yes. And it's poignant and powerful, and my goodness, strong black women, it's one word. She really owns it. And that, and those moments, hashtag, that, those moments between Billy, and you're right, and Kameka, are some of my favourite in the whole series.
So maybe I do like it.
I think you do. That's all I've got from what you're saying is... I actually would like to know why you don't like
well,
it, because I haven't heard
it
that so
because
far.
It would be better if it had a Sontar in it.
It's got amazing drag. Is that okay?
Yeah. All right. Okay.
And just to close out, I will say, because I'm going to send this link to him, I have spoken to Ian Cullen over the internet, who played Ixter.
Golly gosh.
And he is an absolutely lovely, lovely chap. He is actually... what happened was I was talking about the audios I do with Planet Scarrow Audios, and he said, gosh, they sound frightfully interesting.
Hashtag.
And we started talking about those, and he said, well, you know, if I'm ever available, that might be rather fun.
Wow.
And so even...
He's in. Hello, you're in.
Which one was Ixter again?
Shh, the one fighting Ian.
Oh, the hottie.
Sorry. Yes, the hottie. Oh, and actually...
The other hottie.
That brings me
he's so in.
That brings me to another one of Rod's comments.
Hello, Rod.
Which comes from the scene where Ian sneaks out to go through the tunnel and then Ixter locks him in, because of course they're both sleeping on the same floor. And Rod's response was, God, why wasn't the camera here 10 minutes
ago? Hey!
Oh, and there's
can we just say that Rod thought that the Daleks was homoerotic?
Well,
yeah, was that
No, that was correct.
No,
that was him. And I think hastily moving along. Oh yes, there it is. It's time for the Censorites. Richard.
Hurrah! The Censorites, well, how do we all feel about the Censorites?
Well, I feel that an analysis of the Censorites would benefit enormously from detailed knowledge of architectural styles and German expressions.
And thankfully,
oh, let it go.
The moment has been prepared for. And I know it's not 18th century grammatically correct to end with a
preposition.
Thank you, boys. Let's preposition the preposition. I bleep iTunes love this story on so many levels. I love the orange-headed 5'5" aliens in the gimp suits. I love
Stop
they
calling
are actually
me
orange.
That.
Hello, darling. I'm so glad you're here. When are we going to get the cosplay and the Censorites? I really love this story. I love this story for all the reasons of my political narkiness, that it ticks all the boxes. I believe it is essentially post-colonial. It does throw up a whole lot of things that are going on at the time. It really references just why I love this whole first season of Doctor Who. And honestly, I started watching... Have we actually discussed this, gentlemen? When we first started watching Doctor Who, what was our first remembered story?
Well, my first remembered story...
Stand by for this, anyone over a certain age.
It was Rose.
And well, you must remember, I was born at a certain age when there were lots of repeats. So my first remembered story is Carnival of Monsters.
And that's not a bad place to start.
Specifically, the cliffhanger to episode 3, where John Pertwee stumbles out of the Miniscope and collapses.
Oh, that's quite a good one. My first one is Death of the Daleks.
Oh,
that was fantastic. A repeat as well. That was a repeat as well. But yeah, season 11 is not a great place to start.
But I've got to say, as the original generation of viewers here, my first live broadcast in Australia's pure memory is getting totally hooked on Planet of the Spiders and watching it from episode 1 to 6 as a child in primary school. And just, so it was 1975, I think we got it out here. Absolutely hooked. So dark. So mesmeric. John Dearth as the master we should have had after Delgado left. I think he's extraordinary. So much in that Planet of the Spiders and the score and all the rest. And we haven't actually had our Jenny Laird moment this podcast.
No, yeah. That will come up along with the recommendations. Because we can only have one per season.
Please stay listening because it just gets better.
just to segue from a before we get back to the censor rights, have you chaps seen that thing online at the moment, your Doctor Who horoscope? You put in your date of birth and it tells the nearest story broadcast your date of birth.
I think I'm War Games.
I'm actually Tomb, I think. Tomb of the Cybermen. I'm very happy to say that.
I know.
I thought you were a Hartnell baby.
No, outrageous suggestion. No, I'm 67, so I think in the UK. But here in Australia, I think we were a season or two. We started in 65 a bit behind. In Australia, yeah.
Well, funnily enough, with
Fast Wait for hours, it. Wait
with,
for it.
With Fast Tracking, as it was then, about 6 months, I whether you look at the UK or Australia, I'm actually the Five Doctors.
Hey!
Although, if you go with what was broadcast just before me, just a week before my birthday, it's a repeat of Terror of the Zygons Part 1. So, either way, I'm in good company.
No, I think pretty Five Doctors good. Counts. I remember Five Doctors vividly, for God's sake. Yeah, you were in utero.
No,
emerged ex-utero.
I was 2 months old. Five Doctors was broadcast, I think, the 18th of December. Don't quote me. Anyone from Broad DW Cast might be able to confirm that. Right, so...
I just wanted to throw that in, but I just felt that just if I was
people
starting...
People need to know us.
Exactly. They need to know how old we are.
Yeah,
to know us is to love us, as Brent Spiner would say.
It's never
indoctrinated. Okay, so what were you talking about?
If I'd started watching in 63, I've got to say this is still 64, this is still probably my favourite season. Just because it sets everything up and because it has such purity of narrative and introspection, it's got some amazing people talking, working behind it. We talked at the first podcast of if the story was not called Unearthly Child, I felt it had to be called A Little Queer, simply because it is on so many levels. Susan is so odd. Really uncomfortably odd, just like most teenage girls with a, you know, an introspective attitude. It was Julie Birchall, if anyone remembers NME, New Musical Express, the paper for new music in the 80s when everything was good and great and lush and actually still dangerous. She said famously that if any one of you didn't spend their 13th summer school holidays locked in their bedroom listening to music and hating the world, I have nothing to say to you. Don't read my column. I'm totally with her on that. This is the season where we set everything up, we examine everything, it's fresh, it's new, it's exciting, and we're also pointing at the rest of the world around us and saying, what's not working out there? What's uncomfortable? The Censorites is doing everything like this for me. Okay, politically, you kind of got the two levels of what's happening on outside. You've got political crises, as we mentioned earlier, with Mao's great leap forward in 58, that whole pogrom of totally against the people and taking the food and slaughtering between 50 and 70 million. Britain was just, with reportage being slower in those days and coming largely through print media, we were just starting to get to read about this. It was kind of threatening. We were also, as part of, and Australia very much part of the Commonwealth, very much still part of the British Empire. The Queen had only visited, for Australian viewers 10 years before, and it was still very much in our mind. Robert Menzies was still our Prime Minister. We were even We weren't perhaps as conservative as our current government would have us be now, but we were certainly very much of the past and of the empire. This is a story, The Censorites, that looks at what it is to be a colonial empire and what it is to let go of it. Why I really love this story is it's the first one to see, we mentioned post-colonialism before, the first one to see aliens as not other, but actually as people that come up first off as something strange and unusual. And I love the way the first episode's filmed in that very somnambulistic style. It feels like I'm that state of being awake and being asleep, like a David Lynch film, where I'm watching this thing, but it doesn't feel like it's in real time. It's so hazy. It feels like not just the way it's shot and not just the lighting, but the way the actors behave, Maitland especially, the chief pilot, has been criticized as being one of the worst actors in Doctor Who. I really love him because there's a sense of when they're just waking up out of the soporific state. Have you seen Cabinet of Dr. Caligari?
Yes.
It's Robert Avena, I believe it's pronounced. Stop sniggering. Conrad Veidt, amazing, amazing German expressionist cinema, very similar lighting, similar sets.
There it is.
Thank you. Ding-a-ling-a-ling.
Take a drink, everyone.
We've got it.
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of that around in Britain at the time. We'll move on, I promise, eventually. Gorgeous sets. I love that, again, we're looking at our recent history, and I love, again, Ray Cusick's set design. This isn't a quasi-futuristic fabulous spaceship of all silvery George Powell, Day the Earth Stood Still intent. This is a Lancaster bomber. It's got bolt holes and, yes, circular doorways, but it's a really mechanical, functionary, ordinary ship. There's nothing glamorous about it. Even the uniforms, it's functional.
The uniforms.
Yeah. What I love so much about it is that they zip up the back. You can't, like, just like the Censorites.
Just like a mandrel. Just like the Censorites themselves.
Just like Star Trek Next Generation. And you kind of go, how do you reach that zip every morning?
You reach that zip every morning. Yeah, exactly. Not exactly.
God, I'm Janet Fielding. I'm talking about clothes.
I have never, ever wondered that before. Years of Star Trek. Is it just me? Or is it possible in episode one, just to raise the intellectual tone, is it possible that you can see a Censorite willy through the costume in episode one?
The John Hamm meme of budgie.
Well, you know what they say about the size of the Censorite's feet.
Ah. No, I'm sure that you can. There's like one shot where the Censorites like walk through the shot and they're sort of shot. You shoot their crotch.
Are we actually talking about?
No, it's true. And I'm sure that they got more heavy duty underpants for the later, like the later episodes.
Oh.
But there is a definite willy.
So much to read into if you want to go there.
As one says to an ood, is that your translator, Orb? Are you just happy to see me?
Just pleased to see. Hooray! What I also really like about this story and why it's really important for me is that it's the problem of Susan is re-engaged. This is the first story written by this extraordinary man, Peter Newman. And if you haven't seen the doco, the lovely...
It's Toby really Hado. Good, isn't it?
Well, I love Toby Hado, everything he does. But the documentary is so poignant and so kind of sad. He didn't have a great life. But the writer of this... apart from the fact that he'd gone through the war and had this really peripatetic lifestyle of just, you know, odd jobs and really wanted to break into theatre writing and TV writing, and this is his first kind of crack at TV, which starts off really well and ends up really Agatha Christie 1955 in the later episodes. But for the first two, I really love it. And one of the things I really like about it is that he is the first writer to have seen the show going out and seeing what, not just getting the writer's notes. This was scripted. Yeah, this was scripted after he'd seen the Daleks. So those first two stories had gone out.
Yep.
So we're getting a much more interesting play on Billy, on the Doctor's role. And, when we get later on to episode four, I'll talk more about that. But what I really like is that Susan is actually read as still being interesting.
Yeah. I have to agree with that. This might be Susan's best story. And partly that's because She's off for a week or two.
No, no, well, that's Barbara's off
for a week. Barbara's off getting a lovely tan.
Lovely sunray treatment on the spaceship.
Yeah, who knew that this really functional submarine of a spaceship had a tanning?
No, they actually would have to. Vitamin D.
Very true.
Relaxing.
Very true.
One of
so really, you're you trying to justify it.
No, no, you would have to do that.
It makes sense.
You would have to do that.
In diegetic terms.
Yeah.
As well as Susan being very well written in the story and having this psychic ability to play on.
She's interesting, yeah. Well, you remember, you were talking about this last time, that the premise of her character is that she would have exotic, extraordinary clothes, not just the Fidel Sassoon haircut kids, but she'd also have telepathic abilities, and...
Yeah. And, well, not only that, but that then gives her... Because, Ian has managed to save everyone by being strong, and the Doctor's managed to save everyone by being intelligent, and Barbara's managed to save everyone by trying to bring culture to the
and
Aztecs.
And being human,
and
yeah.
Finally, and Susan is able to save everyone... And the thing is, when Susan does it, she actually goes, not only am I going to save you, I'm going to make myself a hostage to save you because that's the only
and
way.
Then,
which is amazingly brave. And Caroline Ford really rises to the material because, you can tell, especially in Keys of Marinus and the Aztecs, she's getting bored, which is understandable because she's been promised this great part with nothing to do. Suddenly the Sensorites comes along, which is maybe not the greatest story ever written, but she is given such wonderful... heroic, intelligent, interesting stuff to do, and she just goes, I'm going to act my socks off.
Fortunately, though, next month she'll be back to being a panicky idiot again.
And you know why? Billy. And it's not actually Billy, I should say the Doctor. There's a really interesting structure here about... It's so good. A young person achieving a voice, finding her voice, finding her role, is cut down immediately. I've never seen that. Until this point, the Doctor being so angry and so hostile, but from this pendulum ridiculousness of, oh, we never argue, speaking of his granddaughter, he completely shuts her down when she says, I'm going to go to the planet and I'm going to actually lead the narrative and I'm going to actually sort this out. You will not contradict me. You're my granddaughter. You don't have adulthood. You're a child. You can really see that moment where Carol Ann Ford, as well as Susan, says, I am so out of here. This is just not... I've got no room to move. I've got no room to be anything. I'm wearing Alice in Wonderland white socks. I'm having to stand here in a pinafore and take this crap. You can really see... Is it episode 4 that where Carol Ann Ford, you can see in her face thinking, this is not going anywhere.
I'm out of here.
And it perfectly mirrors the situation between her grandfather and the granddaughter. Is it the power play? The polemics between the elder. It's lovely that the parents in this is why I think this has such electricity this season, the parents are dissociated and adopted. And it's actually the grandfather and the granddaughter who have had to adopt parental models into their family unit.
And Ian and Barbara are constantly sort of, Susan's talking to them and saying, grandfather's being very difficult. And they're saying, Susan, okay, we'll have a word with him.
Yeah. They're the parents in apotheosis. Yeah. No, they are. They're the parents that the family unit didn't have. And the grandfather being curmudgeonly and brilliant and having all the power because he's got the keys to Narnia's wardrobe says, no, that's, I will rewrite the scene at every moment. What is so lovely about this story is the first time in episode 4 we get the Doctor actually acting as the Doctor. And that's what I meant before when I said it's interesting that we've got the first script that doesn't just come from liner notes. Peter Newman says the Doctor will stay on the planet after he solved the water crisis, after the cultures, after the story plot has been resolved, simply to assist the narrative and be a good person.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the only way he can achieve that is by completely denigrating the Susan character to the point that she has nowhere to go anymore. She grows and then she's bonsai'd.
And even in the last scene, she says, oh, grandfather, I can't use telepathy anymore. Oh, no, darling, that's just the influence of the planet passing.
Exactly.
And it's like, why?
Why? Because screw you, you're not going to be in charge. This is why I hate Five Doctors, because this is after so many years, she's back. She's the vestigial force of this narrative to start off with. She stands in the TARDIS and looking pleadingly at Peter for recognition.
Yeah.
And Peter Davison completely ignores her. I hated that in 1983 and I still hate it now.
It's terrible. And it's what we said before. But it is that thing where they wanted to airbrush over that grand.
Yeah, because that was J&T.
Yeah. And it didn't fit into our neat, list of 38 companions. Something.
Yeah, whatever it was.
Anyway, yeah, so I think like, that's a great lost opportunity. And awful. It would never, ever happen now. Can you imagine Russell T. Davies reuniting Susan and the Doctor and not having it...
This is why I'm so grateful to Russell, yeah.
Well, Susan, when she turns up in the Paul McGann audios, is a brilliant dynamic
there. We will name those at the end as our choices, because, yes, I was going to say that. Yeah. I love these ones.
Okay.
But, yeah, there's this great tension between the fact that, you know, Susan is now in her 60s or 70s.
Yes.
And the Doctor is in his 30s.
Right. Yes, and there's a grandson,
she still
Alex,
calls so. Him really? Grandfather.
Paul McGann wishes.
She still calls him... Yeah, she still calls him grandfather. I won't go too much into that because...
But we'll put it up spoilers, there because it's just lovely.
There's almost certainly a Sontaran in it at some point.
At some point. There is actually a monster.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Yes. Anyway, back to the Sensorites. So I think... I actually really like this one. Do you know what I mean? I've probably expressed 12 different contradictory opinions about it over the course of the podcast already. But I did sort of quite enjoy it. And it is partly because... you know, at this point, it's all sort of something new. And it is because the fake out, you know, like episode one sets up the Sensorites as sort of, you know, terrible, scary monsters.
Evil.
But then it turns out that they're the good guys.
And so vulnerable.
Actually been, yeah, they're really quite vulnerable. And all of that's quite good. And the fact that it, you know, it has a planet and a sort of social structure and stuff and people wear lovely sashes so they can tell each other apart. And
pretty
all of that.
Denuded social structure, though. They don't even have names, and it just seems to be one city. And,
yeah, yeah. But that's, I mean, that's...
It's the first time I can think of that a culture, an alien culture, has been attempted to be described on television over the course of a serial. So, you know, they don't get everything right, but they get this idea that they've got their own hierarchy and their own value structure.
There, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so they don't have names, but maybe they don't have names.
I also quite like just that we get to spend a bit of time with them. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a bit more leisurely. And
I do like the drawn-out nature.
And the real plot really doesn't kick out until episode six. Like, I don't think those soldier guys even appear.
Yeah, I found that very strange. That, you know, you get this reference of, oh, no, these people died out, these people died out. These, and so you think, okay, they poisoned the water supply and then they died.
And now like, they're here.
No, they're here. They're in a cave.
But that's okay. We get some villains and stuff and some drama at the end.
And some lovely post-colonial nods to, you know, Britain's losing their empire, and this is how we now view
and not
our role in that, hiding, you know.
Not only that, but of course Peter R. Newman based those characters who had been in the caves for so long they'd gone mad on prisoners of war, because he was a prisoner of war.
He was.
And
wanted to get, yeah,
it was such a pity, because that little sort of 5-minute scene that those characters have, I thought, that's really interesting. I would have liked to see more of these characters in the episodes later, like just in the background. I would have liked to see them poisoning the water supply and discussing what they were doing.
Then you wouldn't get the reveal.
Yeah, no, I think the reveal's fun, and I think the fact that they wind it all up in an episode is actually sort of pretty good.
It's very atypical. I'll give it that.
But there's nothing to be atypical of yet. Do you
it's
know what I mean?
It's the first one.
Like
exactly.
The third
it's the first
science fiction story.
And it's the first one that sets up all the stuff. It's the first time we're inside a spaceship other than the TARDIS. It's the first one that has that purely technical thing of walking from the TARDIS set into the spaceship, which I don't remember happening again till, okay, maybe Colony in Space, but I don't remember happening again till that moment
it
with
is.
Liz Sladen and Tom in Pyramid of Mars. And I can tell you as a little boy, that blew my head sideways. That was so exciting.
I think the landing on a spaceship, I remember thinking that was really terrific. We can do that. We can
it's
land
so
on a spaceship.
And exactly. And it's just as exciting another. For the audience at the time. We didn't know the TARDIS could do that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is pretty good.
Love it, love it, love it. I'd give it, for the things that it does, if not the way it does it, 9 out of 10.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Because, you see, I find that, like you say, Richard, it's got some very interesting ideas. It doesn't necessarily execute them that well. But where in the Daleks you've got what is a science fiction trope introduced in things like the Time Machine with the Morlocks and the Eloi as the Daleks and the Thals, and where in Keys of Marinus you had sort of stock standard 1940s serial locations.
Yeah.
Here, you do have traditional science fiction ideas. You've got the Earth spaceship, you've got the psychic aliens, but it does turn it on its head. And for that, it really does have to be commended. And it's such a shame that Peter R. Newman didn't get to write either more Doctor Who or more film in general. I think he did a couple of Hammer films, but then didn't write for one reason or another. And he's got a very good grip on character. He's got a very good grip on turning cliches on their head.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a great grip on narrative, but with those two, and given more time, he could have done some really interesting stuff, and I think it's a real shame that we don't have more of him, either in Doctor Who or in anything else.
It is a shame.
In fact, it is, you know, like Richard expressed skepticism that Keys of Marinus was science fiction at all, and there's a sense in which that's right, whereas this is sort of undeniably science fiction in that sort of playing with ideas thing. You know, it's not just people being menaced by monsters, which is what the show essentially becomes. Spoiler alert.
Some of us look for.
But it is a proper science fiction thing with an alien.
It really
race
is.
And stuff.
Manchurian Candidate is a film that came out in 1963 by the extraordinary, violent, and outwardly queer John Frankenheimer. He's actually the. He was the Douglas Camfield in a frock of mainline cinema. He had all of the army intention and the ebullience and the bullishness of Dougie Camfield, but really outwardly queer, openly queer. It's kind of a rare thing in those days, but really strongly so. He's filmed Manchurian Candidate with Lawrence Harvey, Angela Lansbury, Frank Sinatra, interestingly enough. It was a film about mind control and... that had been revealed that the Chinese were doing with spies in their own concentration camps, the spies that they'd captured. They were brainwashing and sending them back to the West. Film didn't actually get full release at the time, although it was shown in Britain. It was shown for a short time, not full release in the US because it was so political. It's nicely suggested in this, and you're kind of wondering where all of this stuff with the telepathy is coming from. I believe that's one of the strong parts of it. It also has one of the greatest Billy fluffs that's generally ignored of this season, when he calls out Stabilizer's Matron in episode 1 rather than Maitland. I'm firmly convinced it's really? Which I think is the 28th season equivalent of Quickness the Screams. We have a lovely nod to Carry On in that one moment.
All right.
Just before,
hear a noise?
Well, just before we move on, I just want to praise Stephen Dartnell's performance as John.
Yeah, it's great.
He's like a primordial David Tennant, really, isn't he?
Yeah, well, and...
a Billy wig, yeah.
It's kind of the thing of, you know, his madman... You can't really appreciate his madman performance until the later episodes when he's restored.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He is so sort of straight down the line, yeah. Really a matinee idol kind of voice. And then you look back, and when he's sort of clutching at Susan's leg and saying, no, I won't hurt them, they're my friends, you go, actually, that's really good.
Yeah, really good.
And he was Yartek leader of the Alien Board.
He was Yartek leader of the Alien Board.
He's got a range.
Yes. From good to leader of the Alien Board.
Yeah.
The only observation I have from Rod on this story...
Oh, here we go. It was homoerotic.
No.
There was a willy in episode 1.
No, but he does wonder...
Sorry.
He does wonder that why, after the Doctor says, you know, they're very sensitive to loud noise, it's like, no, stay back. Why doesn't anyone just scream?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Oh, a sensorites are about to attack me. I'll just scream.
Yeah.
I'll shout obscenities at
but
them.
But they didn't know that.
Well, no, Billy says that they do.
Yeah, but not when they were first. Anyway, not when they were first.
But that's his witty observation. Okay, so, right, there we are. We're at the end of the season.
Hooray.
and it seems a not a moment too soon. So, we're now moving into the Reign of Terror, which... for aptly trivia named. Fans out there, like Marco Polo, has missing episodes, but whereas Marco Polo has all its episodes missing, Reign of Terror only has episodes 4 and 5 missing.
Yes, it is, yes.
And they're animated.
And they are.
Yes, they are animated by an Australian animation studio called, I believe they're called Theta Sigma. The Reign of Terror.
How do we all feel about this?
Well, it's just terrible, isn't it? Really? There's no monsters, there's not a single... Do you know what I mean? If there had been a Varden kind of lurking in that sell. And then, you know, like, it's like la conciergerie, and then there's another room. Yeah. Like, the entire last four episodes are just in these two rooms. It's really just sort of terribly tiresome. The first episode's sort of quite entertaining, although I don't know why suddenly, you know, after all, again, I think this is a sad of a thing, but we had all that hard-won characterization in earlier on in the season, and now he's just going to turf them off his ship.
Because Ian made an offhand remark about, oh, do you know where we're going? Well, I don't know where we're going, but I'm not going to tell you I don't know where we're going. In fact, wherever we're going, you're going there.
And that's exactly it. And Billy says, that's it, you're off the ship. It makes no sense. Other than for the need to have a cliffhanger.
It is. It's the need to have a cliffhanger. You know, and it creates, and they sort of throw it away pretty early on in episode one. And episode one's quite good.
Yeah, I like episode one,
especially the cliffhanger when they pan from the fire to the black night sky, and you just go, oh my god, the Doctor's going to burn to death, and then it's like, no, wait, a boy half his size has dragged him out of the fire. It's okay.
But that's a quite expensive-looking thing. Like, there's a model and there's some stock footage and stuff. It looks really good. Yeah. And then we get the famous, you know, first actual location footage, which we've never had before,
which is Brian Proudfoot.
It's quote-unquote Billy.
It's a robot replica of the by the Daleks.
Spoiler alert.
And you know, like, maybe that scene with the guy who's digging the road is sort of reasonably entertaining. Although, like, why is he not in the plot for so long? I don't really understand it. Mm. And then just the rest of it is them just all going in and out of prison, which is all just sort of
kind of horrendous.
And I think, again, the only thing that I think is fun is because, you know, again, like the Aztecs, we've kind of got a comic book version of history, and so, you know, naturally the aristocrats are good guys because the revolutionaries are killing people. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's this sort of reactionary, crummy politics to it, which Barbara then stands up and addresses, and she tells them all off and says,
like,
you know,
no, that's not what it's like.
These people, I mean, you know, and the actual narrative doesn't do any of that. The narrative is sort of fairly reactionary, but at least within the narrative, Barbara stands up and tells it like it is, and she's fantastic. You know, that's a great moment. But the rest of it's all really exhausting, and Carol Ann continues to degenerate horribly.
She's appallingly.
Terribly bad.
Treated appallingly. I mean, and this is why story is interesting, but only to observe, not to actually be involved with as a viewer. It's like to know the backstory. It's the historical we had to have. It's the most obvious thing to do. We forget that I kind of benefited from this, but doing history at school, French Revolution is still something that was taught and that school children knew a lot about.
Well, that was the book.
It was kind of like, there was that book on the counter, but it was one of the last generation where we were taught about this in schools, both here and in Britain. It's also the one where the stuff going on behind the scenes was a hell of a lot more exciting and interesting and dangerous than the stuff that was happening on screen. We had a director, Heinrich Hirsch, who was kind of a great leap forward, and Verity was being, we forget how experimental she was being in this season, and taking a director who'd only done one other thing she'd seen, a political historical piece. He'd escaped from native Hungary in 56 in the revolution. He was greatly troubled by this and had was already known to have a nervous temperament. The same director who passed out in the filming of episode 3 or 4 in Pinfield took over.
Oh, really?
After that, he was so antagonistic that Carol Ann Ford was apparently yelling to him, well, not yelling, but just saying to the powers that be that I am so out of here. And it was because of this story and because of this director, where there's that famous thing that she's always being put down for the way she was behaving in the cells. Oh no, the rats, and being, you know, pretty much received as being entirely pathetic in this.
Yeah. It's like, I'm going to get my head chopped off, but oh no, I can't face any rats. Yeah.
Well, this is the point. And she was also, and they weren't given direction. He was apparently not the kind of director that, he was just finding his feet. He was finding it really technically difficult to understand how the cameras work. It was like, he got this note that, why must you be so maudlin? he was Hungarian, and he'd seen a revolution. He'd escaped in 56. You think he would have been sympathetic? She's standing there and she's sending notes back. I'm in a sewer-like cell. I'm really ill. I'm surrounded by rats.
And I'm going to be decapitated.
Exactly. I'm feeling a little maudlin right now. It's as if Judith Lucy was present in the narrative way back then.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine Judith Lucy as Susan?
I think we'd have an entirely different show.
Well, Judith Lucy is Barbara.
The car's dead. Oh, yeah. Well, in some ways she is.
You stupid man. You realise you would have died if I hadn't got the food machine working for you? I do a rather reasonable Judith Lucy, which is unfortunate because I'm a man.
You took that bar. I think we should keep that in. They were back in Lime Grove. Horrendous.
Yes,
terrible,
yes,
terrible tiny
they
sets.
They had moved to Riverside,
no room.
But now they're
did
back.
Did I make a Lime
one.
Grove mistake earlier on in the podcast and you were both too polite to mention it?
No, I think you were still correct.
Okay.
No, you're correct. They had gone out, but they were back in Studio D. And this was awful for everybody. Terribly hot. The sprinklers kept going off. The sets kept getting wet. They had to wait for the sprinklers to go. So a lot, she said that the tension, that you see is entirely naturalistic because it's exactly what we were going through. But he would, produce notes as why is she so maudlin? Why is she being so difficult? She said, bloody hell, I'm being nibbled by rats and I'm ill and the way it's written and I'm trying to act my little socks off because I've got nothing else to do and I'm getting copping criticism from everyone, including the fan base today. And she's seen as being really crap and weak in this. I think she's fine. I think she's doing a great job and she's got nothing else to do.
I mean, her performance, whatever about her performance, it is really a problem with the way the character is written.
It's really poorly served.
Carol's a good actress.
Yes.
Especially if...
In this, yes.
Especially season. The Sensorites, she's really good in. Unearthly Child, she's really good in. She's very good in the Daleks. Outside of Doctor Who, she's great in the St. Trinian's film she's in. And also Day of the Triffids.
Yeah.
Do you know, I've never seen that Day of the Triffids. Is it good?
It's good, yeah.
It's good. I would say it's not as good as the 80s TV version, which covers more of the story.
Yeah.
But for a Hollywood adaptation, where they have to shorten the story to 90 minutes, where a lot of those things, they will cut out so much of the intent of the book, it still maintains the spirit. And Carol, she is a supporting character in it, but she is a very memorable character in it.
No, well, I've never seen her in anything else, so it's hard to know. For me, it's hard to know. Yeah. Well, it sounds like in the pilot, she could have played a more detached and more self-possessed alien character who enjoyed the adventures, but here she's just sort of a blubbery, panicky fool, do you know what I mean? And, worse than in any of those stories so far. And, I'm sure that's not Carol Ann's choice, but, gosh, it's really sort of miserable to watch.
It kind of is.
You compare with how self-possessed Jackie is in the same circumstances, it's not real peril, do you know what I mean? She's not with Peter R. Newman in a prisoner of war camp. She's just in Lime Grove pretending to be in a prison cell. You know, we don't need quite that level of hysteria. And I think just the kind of the way that Barbara pitches it, where it's a terrible thing, but she's sort of resigned to it and we're not being forced to sit through a lot of histrionics. Do you know what I mean?
They're on two levels.
Yeah.
And if Carol Ann was on Barbara's level of, okay, I'm really scared, but I'm going to work through it, or if Jackie was on Carol Ann's level of, oh my God, I'm going to panic.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
it wouldn't seem so jarring.
Not fun to watch that.
I think the reason that scene is so jarring is that, and we can't forget this now, it's written by Dennis Spooner, and Dennis Spooner is first and foremost a comedic writer.
Yeah. Yes.
This is actually meant to be seen as a comedy.
Yeah, and I think, the direction doesn't quite pick up
on
it.
No, not at all.
Except for
you've got a non-English speaker. The director had very little English, apparently, when he was making this suit.
He's not quite there yet either. Like, his next story...
Spooner.
Tremendous.
Yes.
And this is not as good as that. Oh, you know, he's still finding his feet as well with Doctor Who.
And it's amazing when you consider that in the time frame we're thinking of, it's either this or the Romans, which got him the job as script editor. And I think it's this because he script edited The Rescue.
Which meant that he was going to get the job.
Yeah.
So Whittaker wrote The Rescue, so he could be script editor.
Yeah.
The love of
German expressionism at all.
Well, I was actually going to segue, if that's okay, to unintentional comedy. If this is meant to be read as a comedy, and I'm, you know, we know that it is, there are little moments like, you know, Barbara playing it with a marmoset accent when they're playing two servants and at the end of the thing. Is this the kind of thing? It is, I suppose, hilarious. But it's the supporting cast. And most, I guess most significantly, we've got James Cairncross as Le Maître and later reveal as James Stirling to give us the campest performance I believe we've ever had. Even Billy's fluffy feathered hat cannot meet James Cairncross's extraordinary performance in this as the Sydney Carton character, The Tale of Two Cities. He's playing Dirk Bogart. That film had just come out a few years before the British Tale of Two. Tremendously popular. And if we're talking about unintentional reveals, the very first Brian Eilon stretch jersey packed lunch reveal was Dirk Bogart's famously well-packed, apparently cinematically, moments of wearing the pantaloons in that film. Anyway, he was kind of well-known for it. But I just can't get over James Cairncross's performance. He actually gives us Duckface and has invented it in 1964. We have the first selfie. We didn't... Doctor Who. Star Trek...
Taken by John Cura.
Exactly. James... you know, Star Trek may have invented the flip phone, but Doctor Who created the Duckface selfie. Watch again. He's doing it the entire way through. The way he looks up William Russell, and there is no other way of saying it throughout all of these episodes, it's carry-on Frenchie. It sets up beautifully that Carol Ann Ford's next big cinematic performance was as the saucy French mistress in The Great Centurion's Train Robbery of 1966.
I have never seen this.
It is
really
well worth watching directly after you watch this one.
Picking up on what you were saying about William Russell, and well, we haven't discussed William Russell much because we've been talking about the strengths of Barbara
and
the deficiencies of Susan.
Yeah.
William Russell is just steady and he's the rock throughout the whole season. And, you know, it's easy to see why people say the show's about Ian for much of the first season. And
is it?
No, it's about Barbara.
It's about Barbara, I would have thought, for the
Fair
first
enough.
Season.
But I think that's a big reason that Reign of Terror falls apart, because Ian is...
so obviously not in the room.
He's on holiday for episodes 2 and 3.
Yeah.
And literally, the plot grinds to a halt. The Doctor gets some new clothes. He gets Ian and... The Doctor gets some new clothes. He gets Barbara and Susan out of jail. And then they go back in.
Yes, I know the reason.
And then he gets called to a meeting with Robespierre, and then Ian is released in time to come back. Ian is kidnapped in time to come back for his holiday, but we don't see him until the following week. And that's all that happens in 2 episodes. But the 2 episodes we've lost are the ones where the plot actually gets going again.
So true.
Do you remember what happened to Robespierre? Because it's like something really horrible.
What happened in real life? Shot in the jaw.
That's right. He actually wanders through the shot. We hear the shot. It's
again that moment that...
So everyone at home knows he's been... All the kiddies at home know he's been shot.
Yeah. We knew the story.
It's kind of horrible.
It's awful.
It's kind of like perhaps not my nieces and nephews, but people my age know that Harold Holt drowned. That's the kind of thing it was at the time, I think, that
even
people knew
more
that
so
Robespierre
because
was shot in the door.
History was not an elective in at that time. You were taught this stuff.
Yeah, so I actually didn't know the shot in the jaw thing, because I'm lamentably ignorant about everything.
I didn't know until Reign of Terror.
Doctor Who taught me that. It's horrible. That is kind of horrible, because he wanders through the thing, the scene, that's happened.
Do you know the reason he was shot in the jaw?
Because he wouldn't shut up, much like our podcast.
He would need his mushrooms.
Well, it's kind of that. But no, it's that even he was respected even by the general public. But the general public realised, like, the ones who knew what he was really like, and I did air quotes around that, realised that if he gets the chance to talk to people, he will convert them to his way of thinking.
He was a great orator.
That's the reason he specifically shot in the jaw. It's like, we don't want to kill him, because
it's
we need to put him on trial.
The opposite of Mr. Abbott, Tony Abbott, He shoots himself in the jaw.
Oh, dear.
And then has to pay his doctor $7.
Hurrah!
Right, so
I think we've done tremendously well. I hope you've been opening a bottle with us. I don't know how you would have survived this without it.
No, so, they're doing it in two bits.
Yeah,
we've actually recorded this in one session with just minor loo breaks. So I think
Turdus breaks. We officially know.
So first of all, we've got to discuss the Jenny Laird Award for the most Jenny puzzling Laird creative choice. So do we have any nominees?
Well, again, I have to nominate James Cairncross for giving me just so much duck face for so little in return. I really, really love what he managed to do for me. It rescues Reign of Terror from being something I would have done a lot of ironing instead of.
I like that. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm being forced to come up with an opinion on the spot. I didn't think. What do we think? Maybe I would give Terry Nation the Jenny Laird Award.
Ooh.
And it really is just, you know, I still don't buy the idea that it's a clever, unexpected fusion between hard science fiction and action-adventure story. I think it is just...
The Daleks, you mean?
Yeah. I think he's just run out of things to do at the end of episode 4. And he goes, oh, crap, I've still got another 3 episodes.
Let's have a swamp.
He's even wound it up. We found the fluid link. We're ready to go. Everything's resolved. Off we go. And it's just like the terrible sinking feeling that we have just 3 more episodes of creeping slowly through, you know, unimpressive-looking corridors to go.
Got it.
Because he can't think of anything else to do for the next 7 episodes. And that's really it. He's out of things, probably, by that. You know, it'll just be recycling from here on in, I think.
I believe in Oprah speak, we need to own that.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
Well, I suppose my nominee for the Jenny Laird Award for the most puzzling creative choice is Daphne Dare, who is the costume designer for much of this series, but specifically, because she does loads of good stuff, I'm just questioning one puzzling creative choice, which is, why is Altos wearing a pair of Speedos in
The
Keys of Marinus? Why does he have no shorts, no trousers, no kilt, no anything?
He's got a cape.
He's got a cape, that's true. I suppose you could say it's inverting the whole thing of he's scantily clad and showing off her legs while Sabitha has a collar-to-floor dress. I suppose you could say that. But it's just rather odd, especially seeing as Altos seems to rather enjoy having his thighs rubbed. Sorry, I'll do that as Judith Lucy. It is rather odd, especially when you consider that Altos rather enjoys having his thighs rubbed for warmth by Ian. But then again, who wouldn't?
I really like that you drop down to tenor to Judith Lucy from your own range.
According to my audition, my failed audition, I should say, for the creative arts school at Wollongong University, I am a baritenor. So there you go.
There you go.
That's not a
would make Jude a bass baritone, I guess.
They actually made that up just to kick me
just
out.
Just to kick you in the ass. What about gorgeous things that we should then go and have a look at?
Picks of the week.
My picks of the week are About Time.
Hurrah.
We have a copy here, which you can see at home through the microphone.
The space-time visualizer.
And Brendan's presenting it to the microphone, so you can all...
Brendan is presenting.
I'm presenting the book to the microphone.
Yeah, sorry, the book.
It's Mr. Tat Wood and Mr. Lawrence Miles.
So it's the increasingly crazy and immensely decreasingly crazy involved Lawrence Miles plus Tat Wood.
And Tat Wood, who used to wash his hair with dishwashing liquid and wear a pith helmet.
There you go.
When children. We used to know him. So, we love your Tat.
So it's a series of 7 books. The first 6 are on the classic series. And the 7th book, which is only recently released, covers series 1 and 2 of the new series. And it really is just some of the most extraordinarily detailed writing. There's a thing about sort of Doctor Who books and Doctor Who program guides where you sort of think, I could do that in my sleep. Do you know what I mean? I could get a couple of my friends together and sit on a couch and just bloviate without doing any research or preparation for like hours.
Not at all like this. No.
but About Time is meticulously researched. Yeah. It's really, really
And they
funny.
Don't agree. They don't no. get on. No. So you get some really good moments. I just don't think so.
Yeah,
I like that.
It's terrifically well written. And if you need to know anything about the production, it's all there. Yeah. Like, it's not just people's opinions. There's lots of concrete detail about the production and lots of really interesting stuff about the world into which each episode was transmitted. But it is... uproariously entertaining and funny. Just terribly well written, terribly, terribly good. Well worth a look. Really terribly, terribly good stuff. And if you're at all interested in the sort of history of Doctor Who's production, there's really nowhere else you can go for that sort of information.
Well, my recommendation for this month, going from physical in print books to a book that did have a very small physical print run, but I believe you can still get it as a PDF, and we'll include a link on the website. It's The Wonderful Book of Doctor Who 1964.
Ooh, golly.
What? And what it is, when Matt Smith started as the Doctor, instead of doing annuals, the BBC started doing The Brilliant Book of Doctor Who, very well edited by Clayton Hickman.
Yeah, we love his work.
Well, this is a book done in that style, but for Billy's first season. Have you guys not seen it?
No.
I think I've got the PDF.
This didn't come as a little extra in one of the DW.
No, that was another
one. Because that's great.
That was very different. Yeah. But no, so this is exactly in that style. With fake interviews with Hartnell.
No.
And you get a map of Marinus.
Oh.
If anybody's familiar with the Velvet Jacket DVD covers website, the artist on there, Joe Cannon, is one of the artists who put this book together. I believe he's the head artist, but if you're the head artist and you're listening, I do apologise for getting that
wrong. Please let us know.
Please let us know.
This is called
The Wonderful Book of Doctor Who 1964.
Gotta get this.
It's absolutely beautiful. I have a PDF. I hope I meant to have that. I believe it's available for free download, but the limited print run has ended.
Okay.
But it still looks beautiful on your computer screen. So that's my recommendation. Google it. We will also include a link.
Yeah, please. I'm really looking forward to seeing that. Well, as representing the Elder fandom here by default, if not choice, I've got to say print medium is the first way I got to catch up with Doctor Who in the 70s and 80s, and it's still my first go-to of choice. Please, if you haven't read them, find everything that David Whittaker has ever written and read it. I know that it's the popular thing now to listen to the audios, but honestly, you don't have the subtleties of your own interpretation and your own voice that you get from just reading a paper book back novel. I think there's only three. There's David Whittaker in An Exciting Adventure with the Daleks. I know it's meant to be Doctor Who, but we'll play it this way. The Crusades, and the third
No,
was...
he didn't write The Zabi. That was Bill Strutton.
It was Bill Strutton.
Yeah, so it is just those two.
It is just the two. Yeah. Okay, because I was... Yeah, oh, look, glorious.
If I can just add to that, Richard, you don't need to track down a copy of the originals because both of those have been reprinted
by
BBC Books.
They have been reprinted and they're out right now with a lovely introduction. And yeah, you can also get them as PDFs.
I actually have the Audible.com audiobook of William Russell reading Doctor Who in an...
And I have heard that because BBC 4 played it last year, and it's beautiful. But I honestly say, if you're used to hearing or getting your Target novels as audios, just for these two, go back and read them in print because your own voice will make a difference.
They are actually quite beautiful, and something to look out for in both of them, really, is David Whittaker really focuses on and captures the relationship between Ian and Barbara.
Yeah.
Completely. I won't say anything more than that.
I think it's interesting to see how much the script editor's role was really involved, because Dave Whittaker was script editor. So much of his voice, after reading the books, I can now see in that first series.
So there we have it. I think that's everything we've got to say about the first season of Doctor Who. So we'll be back next month with another two-part podcast in July for Doctor Who Season 2. So we'll be looking at all the stories from Planet of Giants through to the Time Meddler inclusives.
Such a lot. I'm so excited. It's a great year.
It's a fantastic year.
Yeah, we say goodbye to Susan and we say hello to Vicky.
Whoa,
we
do. Thank God.
Yes.
But we are getting ahead of ourselves, so I'm going to say goodbye.
Oh, goodbye.
And goodbye and thank you.
You have been listening to Flat Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, So Maudlin, was recorded on June the 1st in Sydney, Australia. The next episode will be released on July 20th. You can find us at flatthroughentirety.com or on Twitter at FTE Podcast. I'm going to go into a room in which no light will shine and fill that room with noise. It's a One Direction concert. because you see, I think it's got very interesting ideas. I don't rate it that highly though, but I find it. That's okay. It was just.
It wasn't a Dalek.
That's right.
It wasn't a Dalek.
I find that.